Thank you, Chief Judge Flom. May it please the court. In this case, Detectives McCabe and McNally were held liable for depriving Mr. Newsom of his right to a fair trial, and judgment was entered against them in the amount of $15 million. This morning, I will address three of the issues raised by this appeal: qualified immunity, testimonial immunity, and the admission of Dr. Wells' testimony. On qualified immunity, the first prong, of course, asks whether, even taking the evidence most favorably to the plaintiff, does he disclose a constitutional violation. In the prior appeal, this court denied qualified immunity, but invited reconsideration after the facts had been developed, and identified the critical issue, whether the detectives were, and I quote now, seeking to misdirect or mislead the prosecutors in defense. In this entire record, we submit, and the district court, in fact, could identify only one two-line snippet of testimony produced by the plaintiff that went to that dispositive issue of whether the detectives did anything to prevent the prosecutors.
Then I'm not sure, Mr. Rosenthal, why your pitch deals with qualified immunity. Why aren't you just arguing that the evidence doesn't demonstrate a violation of the Constitution?
Well, of course, we are. I mean, the court tells us qualified immunity.
It's not clear that you are, because you don't say that you made the right motion. And, of course, your adversary says that, unfortunately, for good or ill, the city of Chicago agreed to a jury instruction under which the jury was allowed to find a constitutional violation, not from misdirection or lies by the defendant, but simply by inaction of the defendant.
Well, if I could deal with that question, and what I think is it's two parts, Judge Easterbrook. With respect to the jury instruction, qualified immunity is a question of law. It can be raised after trial regardless of whether there's objection to the jury instructions. That said, this jury instruction did require the jury to find deliberate suppression. Now, deliberate is a term of art in our due process jurisprudence. We did make a tactical decision not to submit a bunch of technical jury instructions about what deliberate means. We thought, as a tactical reason, a bunch of technical
jury instructions. Put deliberate to one side, the instruction seems to tell the jury that if the defendants failed to spontaneously reveal what they know, then the jury should bring back a verdict for the plaintiff. Now, that's out of compliance with our instructions, but if you made a tactical decision to permit that jury instruction, it seems to me very difficult for you now to stand up and reverse course through the lens of qualified immunity.
Well, that's precisely why we argue, there's no question, as a matter of taking this case to the jury, we thought there was only one thing the jury was going to understand. Either you believe Mr. Browns or you don't. But qualified immunity puts on a separate layer of protection. We think the court in Rakovich, the en banc court in Rakovich, ruled even if the jury instructions are unobjected to and even if they are at best an incomplete statement of the law.
They're an incorrect statement.
Or incorrect. And that was...
And if it's an incorrect statement is agreed to by the party now complaining, seems to me you can't complain. You've just accepted that as a statement of law.
Well, Your Honor,
otherwise what we're doing effectively is bypassing the rule that requires a party complaining about the jury instructions to object to those jury instructions in the district court. We've said that in civil cases, there's no plain error doctrine allowing us to critique the jury instructions that are not objected to by the parties.
You're
trying to use a qualified immunity argument to get around that rule, and it's a very important rule.
Your Honor, with respect, that rule has never been announced, at least in an opinion with which I'm familiar, in the context of qualified immunity. We believe qualified immunity is a separate two-pronged defense that creates a question of law for the court. We certainly concede that you have to take the evidence most favorably.
What you're effectively saying is that the normal rules of civil procedure don't apply if the defendant is a public official. Because a public official can always argue qualified immunity, and therefore, in your view, the public official can always get a decision on the merits, even if the jury instructions were wrong, even if no Rule 50 motion was timely made in the district court. All of the procedural rules.
I apologize for interrupting, but it's critical. We made a timely motion in the district court on Rule 50.
But you did not object to the jury instruction.
We did not. That's correct, Judge Easterbrook. But I just want to make that clear.
You're saying that when the defendant is a public official, the defendant need not object to the jury instructions. because the defendant can always make a qualified immunity argument and it will just pierce all these procedural issues.
And the evidence must be taken most favorably to the plaintiff and most favorably to the verdict. But yes, we are saying qualified immunity gives public officials a separate two-pronged layer of protection regardless of what issues were submitted to the jury because it is a question of law. We are submitting it. Having said that, on this snippet of testimony, our submission is straightforward. The only snippet of testimony is Mr. Rounds, when asked, why didn't you tell the prosecutors that you really didn't see the shooter, he says, and I quote, because I was told by the police that I would be charged with perjury or something or contempt of court. Now, when that testimony is taken in context, we submit it cannot support the weight of this judgment. Mr. Rounds, by his own account, had participated in the creation of a composite sketch and had verified it looked like the shooter. That's what the detectives knew when they led Mr. Rounds into the lineup. Then, that sketch, which bore an uncanny resemblance to Mr. Newsom, in fact, the sketch looks a lot more like Mr. Newsom than the so-called real shooter, Dennis Emerson. But when Mr. Rounds comes face-to-face with someone who looks like the sketch for the first time, not only does he say he can't make an identification, he says, I never even saw the guy. The detectives could reasonably be skeptical about that, and for that reason, the detectives could reasonably say, which is all they are claimed to say by Mr. Rounds himself, look at number three, focus on number three, because they could reasonably have thought they were dealing with a recalcitrant witness. And after that, Mr. Rounds, by his own account, makes an unequivocal identification and never backs off of it. Never says, you know, I'm only saying this because you told me to. In fact, he never backs off of it for 19 years, even his first deposition in this case. And even putting aside the jury instruction issue, the detectives could have reasonably believed that that information wasn't material within the meaning of Brady. And, of course, materiality was also a requirement under this instruction. It should be up to the prosecutors to make legal judgments like materiality. These officers could have reasonably believed that the prosecutors would have discharged their own Brady obligation and that one snippet of testimony establishes nothing by a preponderance of the evidence more than that the police said something about perjury or contempt. Now, of course, that's quite common. Police officers frequently admonish witnesses, especially...
Oh, please. I mean, if the jury believed the account of this, that the police officer said, look at number three, look at number three, look at number three, I hope police officers don't usually do that in lineups.
Well,
I mean, that's not the same. You're characterizing the facts in a way the jury might have believed, but they didn't.
Well, with respect, Judge Wood, Mr. Rounds said no more than look at number three.
Mr. Rounds' testimony indicates that they repeated a couple of times, focus on number three. They didn't say pick number three. He doesn't testify that. But the jury could have interpreted the direction to focus on one particular member of the lineup as a hint, if you will, that that's the guy. And if you're telling me that that's what the Chicago police officers usually do in lineups and that that's perfectly okay, in your opinion, I'm shocked.
Well, let me be clear, Judge Wood. We perfectly accept, given that testimony that was credited, that this reflects, at best, a lack of due care, unreasonable police conduct.
How can that be? I mean, if what the jury is taking all the inferences in the light most favorable to the jury verdict, with the background of your discussion with Judge Easterbrook, where there are no objections to the instructions and the jury answers the specific interrogatories given to it, then we have to assume that these detectives, in effect, told Mr. Rounds to pick number three. And I am not aware of any law that says when you have a lineup, the police can tell the witness who's looking at the lineup which person to pick.
Well, Judge Wood, let me be clear. I am not here to defend the police conduct as the jury found it. I am here to denounce it at a minimum.
And you have to accept, this case needed a trial. I mean, you could have persuaded the jury that nothing...
I really don't want to quarrel with Your Honor on this point. What I want to move on to is the point, you actually can't find a case anywhere in the country that says it's unconstitutional to say, look at number three. You can't even find a case that says it's unconstitutional to pick number three. Because the law says even an impermissibly suggestive lineup.
That's beyond impermissibly suggestive. If I'm sure there aren't cases that say pick number three because everybody knows you can't do that.
Well, but the test is two-pronged. Even when the lineup is impermissibly suggestive, even when it gets suppressed, this court held in Montgomery, even when the lineup was suppressed, a subsequent in-court identification can be submitted if the court finds under the totality of circumstances it's reliable.
Right, but this is your whole theory of how we have to delve into the trial. And our case in Ianco indicates that there's, and I think our previous opinion in this case, there's a separate issue about what happens outside the courtroom before the trial. And if the police, in fact, never, and the police would have had every reason not to tell the prosecutor that this is what they were doing, because the prosecutor would have had a different set of responsibilities, and as Judge Easterbrook's earlier opinion indicated, you can't blame the prosecutor for what they absolutely didn't know about. This outside the courtroom misconduct is a separate problem for us.
Well, Your Honor, maybe the outside misconduct could have given rise to a separate constitutional tort. That's not the claim
that this case was about.
Well, Judge Wood, that's not the issue the plaintiffs put to the jury. They only put one theory to the jury, that the trial was unfair. Maybe they could have fashioned a separate theory that there was an independent constitutional tort that was over when the lineup was complete. But they didn't ask the jury to make a finding. They never pressed such a claim. And that brings me, in fact, to the issue of testimonial immunity. Because I want to begin where the district court began, which is subordination claims, the district court ruled, are subject to immunity. And that the district court reasoned, we think quite correctly, was compelled by this court's holding in House versus Belfer. Our submission on the Brady claim that did go to the jury is that it is no different than the immunized subordination claim, because claims based on the suppression of exculpatory evidence can always be recharacterized.
But does that mean, I suppose, that you think that the statement in our earlier opinion, quoting, that if the right characterization of the defendant's conduct is that they deliberately withheld information seeking to misdirect or mislead the prosecutors in the defense, then there was a genuine constitutional problem, close quote, is an error?
Your Honor, with respect, we think that sentence is exactly right. But there's a separate question. Can you impose damages liability for that constitutional error, given the doctrine of testimonial immunity, which was not at issue in the prior appeal? That defense was only raised after remand when the plaintiffs recharacterized their claim in conformity with this court's opinion. Our submission is, if subordination is immunized, and it is, that's common ground between the parties, suppressing exculpatory evidence about that same witness's testimony must be immunized as well, because all subordination claims can be recharacterized as Brady claims. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court told us in Imbler against Pacman when it refused to draw that distinction in the context of prosecutorial immunity. Finally, I want to go to the admission of Dr. Wells' testimony. Dr. Wells purported to be able to tell if an eyewitness has been improperly coached.
What he was saying, I thought, was that there's a natural error in identification, and then there are things that can't be explained by natural error. But putting that to one side, how important was Dr. Wells anyway? He's just a little piece of this whole trial.
Well, we think it is critical because the plaintiff's entire case rests on Mr. Rounds' testimony.
On Dr. Wells' testimony, it rests on Mr.
Right.
Rounds.
Right. Mr. Rounds told a different story six prior times. He repudiated three sets of his prior testimony.
And the jury knew that.
And the jury knew all that. There was only one piece of evidence that corroborated Mr. Rounds, and this was this so-called scientific evidence that science can tell that Rounds' current version is the truth.
Well, no, I think that's not what Dr. Wells testified to. I think in a loose way, maybe it corroborates that people make mistakes, but I think the jury was just faced with the decision, which version of Mr. Rounds do we believe?
Judge Wood, I ask you to do only one thing, and then I'll say no more on this subject. I implore you, and I know you will, to read the closing and rebuttal arguments of the plaintiffs to the jury. Dr. Wells' testimony was stressed over and over again to the jury.
I would be more interested in reading social science literature. There's a large and growing literature about the accuracy of eyewitness identification. And I would be interested in being sent to someplace to, in that literature, that might suggest that Wells was using improper scientific methods, or methods that are understood to be wrong, or even methods that aren't understood to be right.
Let
me tell you what struck me about your brief. Your brief doesn't cite anything from that literature. You're just asking us to react as lawyers to Wells' testimony. But whether it's right or wrong doesn't depend on what we learned in law school. It depends on what perceptual psychologists have learned. And it's that literature that I'd like to be referred to.
Well, Your Honor, the reason our submission on appeal goes that way is we actually assume that Dr. Wells used a reliable method to study what he studied. Our quarrel with his testimony is not that his method wasn't reliable, it's that he was studying a phenomenon irrelevant to the case. His method is for determining whether a witness makes an honest mistake in identifying. That's his testimony. And he actually shows a picture to his test subjects of the real shooter, Mr. Emerson, to see if someone who'd actually seen Mr. Emerson would honestly mistake Mr. Newsom for Mr. Emerson.
Yeah.
The problem here is that's not what the evidence showed happened. Mr. Round's current version is he never saw Mr. Emerson. So the test...
No, but that's
not... sounds to me like an argument to the jury. It's not a reason to exclude the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, Daubert tells us there's a two-pronged analysis here. This is the second prong of Daubert, the second gatekeeping function of Daubert.
The argument you're making is not a Daubert argument. It's a Rule 401 argument that irrelevant testimony is not admitted, you've now characterized your argument. It has nothing to do with Daubert. Rule 401 doesn't, and Rule 702 are completely different rules. Daubert is about Rule 702.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps the evidence could have also been excluded under Rule 401 or 403. We did make a Rule 403 objection to this evidence as well. But putting that aside, we do believe that Daubert's second prong, which says, is this a reliable method for studying the phenomenon actually at issue, like the Joyner case, where in Joyner the Supreme Court said the study was reliable as a method of determining how cancer develops in rats, but not how cancer develops in human beings. That is argued the phenomenon studied here simply wasn't what the plaintiffs described. I'll rest on our brief on the other issues and reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Rosenthal. Ms. Gallagher.
The court recognized the legal basis for James Newsom's Section 1983 claim in the first interlocutory appeal in this case. Appellants made a tactical decision not to challenge the manner in which that claim was submitted to the jury or the legal standard upon which Judge Plunkett based his rejection of the qualified immunity defense. Their view is that they can leave those issues unchallenged in the district court and wait for a second appeal on the same issues to arise to raise their concerns. This court held in the interlocutory appeal that if Mr. Newsom proves what he alleges, then he will establish a constitutional violation for which the officers do not enjoy any immunity.
But in their Rule 50 motion after the trial, I mean, they were preserving their qualified immunity argument all the way through. Would you agree with that? As Mr. Rosenthal was just saying, kind of as a separate and distinct reason why they should prevail?
With respect to the specific issue they're raising now, which is that they're entitled to qualified immunity because Mr. Newsom did not make out his cause of action, did not prove the facts sufficient to establish a cause of action, with respect, we believe that issue was not preserved because not only did appellants not object to the jury instructions in this case, but they proposed special interrogatories to guide Judge Plunkett's assessment of qualified immunity. And in the special interrogatory that they proposed to guide the factual determination, they don't include the factual element they claim now to be missing from the jury verdict.
So you bet your position is basically they've just got to live with what they gave the judge, and that to the extent qualified immunity is different from the merits, doesn't essentially collapse into the merits once the facts are all decided, there's nothing that would show that.
Our position is that they've waived the arguments they're now making, as a separate argument. If, however, the court were to reach that question, we believe there's ample evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict, and that there is there's a factual finding in this case that the officers deliberately concealed or deliberately failed to disclose material exculpatory evidence. That evidence begins with the evidence that they manufactured eyewitness identifications in the first place. They further testified, Officer McNally testified, that he did not tell the prosecutors about the misconduct at the lineup, despite sitting down and speaking with them about the police reports and his investigation of the case. They further took affirmative steps to prevent others from disclosing the conduct of the lineup.
Now, can you distinguish this? Mr. Rosenthal thinks you can't distinguish this from suborning perjury. What's the difference?
The difference between this case and suborning perjury is the nature of the constitutional harm alleged. House versus Belford recognized a small extension of the testimonial immunity doctrine to prevent artful repleting of claims for subornation of perjury, where the harm is, at core, a witness perjuring himself at trial. In this case, there was no claim of perjury. There was no evidence of perjury. There was no argument that Anthony Rounds or Josie Nash or any witness perjured themselves. In fact, the argument was that Mr. Rounds may very well and probably did think he was telling the truth. The problem in this case was that he was manipulated outside of court at the lineup, and that manipulation was deliberately concealed. The Brady claim of concealing exculpatory evidence, the act that we're concerned about, is the concealment that took place outside of court and the misconduct of the police officers that took place outside of court. This case falls squarely within the ruling in Iancu, which concerned a claim based on this court's prior ruling in Newsom, the first Newsom appeal, and a claim of absolute witness immunity that is indistinguishable from the claim that appellants are now asserting. On the question of absolute immunity, the Seventh Circuit has never extended House beyond the specific circumstance that is at issue in that case, which was a blatant effort to recharacterize a claim for perjury as a claim for conspiracy to commit perjury. In House, in fact, the defendant was the immune witness himself. And that is an entirely different circumstance than the circumstance the court faces here today.
Mr. Gallagher, did Mr. Rounds explain to the jury why his version of the events had changed so dramatically?
No. He did not explain why his version of the events changed dramatically beyond saying that what he was testifying to them about, the events as he was describing them, was the truth, and that he had not previously disclosed what happened at the lineup because he was threatened by the officers.
So why isn't that, you've just said there's no issue about perjury, and I realize we're not redoing the criminal trial. So he just says, this is what really happened, maybe I was mistaken, you've just said maybe he was mistaken. That's different from him saying, I did the wrong thing because I was afraid.
Well, he certainly didn't say that I lied to the jury in the criminal case. In fact, his testimony was that he believed he was telling the truth to the jury in the criminal case. Undoubtedly, there were inconsistencies in Anthony Rounds' testimony, but those inconsistencies, certainly to the extent they go to his credibility, were inconsistencies that the jury was charged with weighing and assessing and in deciding whether to believe his version of events. And the version of events that was provided by Mr. Newsom himself, who had less understanding, less perception of what happened at the lineup, but he saw some things that further established that the officers were manipulating the eyewitnesses during the lineup.
Well, isn't that the basis of the jury's finding with respect to Nash, Mr. Newsom's own testimony that he saw gesturing?
That and the totality of the evidence demonstrating that these officers undertook deliberately throughout their investigation to rig the evidence against Mr. Newsom. Not only do we have the coaching or the instruction to Mr. Rounds to pick number 3, despite his clear statement that he could not identify the murderer in the lineup,
Well, you agree they never said pick number three. They said things like focus on number three or look, I can't remember the exact word, but it was directing his attention to number three.
What they said was tantamount to pick number three, because what happened was Mr. Rounds came in to view the lineup and said, I don't recognize the man who murdered Mickey Cohen. I don't recognize his voice. I don't recognize his face. He's not in this lineup. And then and only then did the officer say, we have the man who murdered Mickey Cohen. We have evidence that number three did it. Look at number three. Focus on number three. In our view, that... And this
record
is the
will show they actually said, we have evidence that number three did it.
Yes, we have evidence that the man who committed this murder is in the lineup, and we have evidence it's number three. Pick number three. Look at number three. It's tantamount to pick number three out of the lineup. And this is not a circumstance of a reluctant eyewitness being given a little encouragement. This was a witness who could not identify the perpetrator in the lineup, who was told to pick number three. And in light of the other evidence of the officer's conduct in the investigation, their conduct in showing another eyewitness, and there are only three eyewitnesses in the case, showing the Williams a photo array, which we submit and submitted to the jury was a suggestive photo array, the day of the lineup, right before they took him to the lineup, they showed this witness a photo array with Mr. Newsom's picture in it. And of course, none of the other people whose pictures were shown to Mr. Williams on the day of the lineup were in the actual lineup. And Mr. Williams' testimony was, I went to the lineup and I was asked to identify the person whose picture I had been shown.
Could I ask you, following up on one of Judge Easterbrook's questions, what evidence was in the record to support the methodologies that Dr. Wells was using with respect to lineups?
The only evidence in the record concerning the reliability of Professor Wells' testimony, and I understood appellant's counsel to be conceding that they do not challenge the reliability of Wells' testimony, is Wells' testimony itself. He provided ample basis for the district court to determine that his testimony met the reliability prong of Daubert. He testified that the methodology was peer-reviewed, that he relied upon it in other studies, that it was repeatable, and that it was accepted in the scientific community. Recall,
they didn't challenge that.
And they never challenged that. They didn't take him on voir dire. They didn't object at trial after we established the reliability of his testimony.
Well, and then I recall they conceded he was an expert, too, which is,
yes,
in a sense, a separate... There's methodologies, but is the person applying the methodologies expert? Answer yes, or at least they didn't challenge that either.
No, and the only argument that appellants appear to be pressing on appeal with respect to Wells is the suggestion that his testimony was not helpful to the jury.
No fit. And then what's your response to that?
Yes, and the helpfulness of Professor Wells' testimony is apparent from the arguments made to the jury. There was a question in this case whether the eyewitness... There's no question in this case whether the eyewitnesses made a mistake. They undoubtedly did. James Newsom did not kill Mickey Cohen. That is an established fact. The only question was why three eyewitnesses all misidentified the killer at the lineup, and why they all three picked the same wrong person. And Professor Wells was offered to testify that wasn't a mistake, that it wasn't the result of what he testified.
It wasn't natural error.
Correct. He did not testify that it was the result of coaching, or that it was the result of any specific act of the defendant. He was precluded from offering that testimony. He testified generally about the types of things that could cause misidentifications other than natural error. But the focus of his testimony was the highly relevant question of whether this was a simple mistake or whether some external influence came to bear. And that's an entirely different subject than the subject matter of the eyewitness expert testimony in the case at the appellant's site, where eyewitness experts are excluded in criminal cases, where the only purpose of calling them is to question the credibility of an eyewitness that the jury will be hearing from in the trial. It's an entirely different circumstance. With respect to the remaining arguments on appeal, the challenge to the district court's discretionary rulings on the admissibility of evidence and the district court's alleged failure to devote adequate attention to appellant's informal request for discovery sanctions. As we explained in our brief, the district court acted well within its discretion, and appellants have provided no basis for reversal or remand on any of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gallagher. Ms. Rosenthal.
Thank you, Judge Flom. Chief Judge Flom, let me first turn to the waiver issue, whether the qualified immunity defense was waived by failing to object to the jury instruction. Our position consistently has been this case never should have gone to the jury because, among other reasons, qualified immunity. We moved for a directed finding before the jury was instructed. We moved for a directed verdict after the verdict was returned. And the proof that there was no waiver here is in the district court's own ruling, in the district court's post-trial ruling. The district court didn't find a waiver. He treated with our defense on the merits. You can find it in our appendix. It's page A63, footnote 1. The district court specifically reached the issue.
It's not your position, I take it, that everything the district court says is true and therefore must be followed on appeal.
Well, it actually is our position.
You are, after all, asking us to reverse the district court.
Judge Easterbrook, it is our position that even if when there is a waiver, when the district court forgives the waiver and reaches the issue on the merits properly before the court on appeal, we cite cases.
Then the Court of Appeals must reach it? I don't see how a district court can give away a legal argument that the other side possesses.
Well, we do cite cases in the reply brief that says that when the district court forgives a waiver, it has discretion to forgive a waiver. If the waiver is forgiven, it's out of the case. But put that aside.
No.
Because
the rule says a person must object to a jury instruction. How can a district court just give away that rule?
Well, Your Honor, we aren't seeking to get a waiver of the jury instruction. What we are seeking to do is get a waiver of our, if there was any waiver on the rule, but on failure to object to the jury instruction, that's beside the point. Our argument was on the sufficiency of the evidence. But put that aside.
As we said, sufficiency of the evidence is judged in relation to the jury instructions, because otherwise you just have a backdoor attack on the instructions.
Well, then, Judge Easterbrook, let me go to prong two of qualified immunity, because there is a separate prong, whether this law was clearly established in 1979, that certainly does not go to the jury. Nobody thinks we had to submit a jury instruction on that. That is what, frankly, puzzles me the most about the plaintiff's position here, because there's no question that the second prong was waived. Having said all that, let me turn to the question of the lineup. I agree with everything Mr. Gallagher said about the lineup. Taking the evidence most favorably to the plaintiff, he's right, and it was, at best, gross negligence. But there's no case. The claim the plaintiff asked the jury to find on was not that the lineup was unconstitutional. It was that the trial was unfair. And we submit that claim is barred not only by qualified immunity, but by testimonial immunity. If the court would bear with me one more minute, I really want to say something quite critical about testimonial immunity. Mr. Gallagher says his claim wasn't based on perjury. Now, Mr. Round's current version is that he never saw the shooter and that he was coached by the police improperly. I know the court will review his testimony at the criminal trial. He testified that he saw the shooter very clearly, and that nobody coached him. This couldn't be more clearly based on perjurious testimony adduced at trial. That's the claim that went to the jury, was the trial unfair, and we submit that testimonial immunity attaches. In the Ianco case, whatever else you can say about Ianco, there was one non-immunized claim in Ianco, which is that out of court, the police corruptly persuaded the prosecutors to bring charges. That's not the claim that Mr. Newsom brought to this jury. We submitted it immunized. We respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be reversed. Thank you for indulging me, Chief.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.